And our special guest tonight, Mark McKinlish, and we'll be back with Mark in a moment as we get into anti-gravity propulsion. Is it out there? And where did it come from? Maybe from up there? Who knows? And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Mark McKinlish, our guest. I want to break into my Braveheart accents of my Scottish and Irish accents, Mark, every time I hear that great last name of yours. Is it Scottish or Irish?
Scotch-Irish.
Is it?
It originated with, I think it was the Quinlis clan, and then became McQuinlis, and then McCanless, and then McCandlish. And evolved over the course of about 800 years, I guess.
I want to yell out the name William Wallace every time I hear your name. That was a great movie, too, by the way.
It was. It really was. In fact, in the opening scene where Mel Gibson rides into a clearing and he's calling one of his compatriots, he actually calls out the name McCandlish.
You're right. You're right. Absolutely. I remember that.
I was kind of floored when I heard that.
Yep. You are right. It was the guy you used to always get into the fights with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah. Okay.
Right.
Hey, anti-gravity propulsion. First of all, explain what that is. It seems obvious, but give us some more details.
Well, I want to try and keep this as easy and as simple to understand as I can. So I'm going to try and skip all of the heavy physics talk and just kind of lay it out in the most basic terms. Everything in the universe that we are aware of is made up of atoms. They're like little tiny solar systems with a nucleus in the middle, just like a sun, and then all of these electrons that spin around the nucleus, just like the planets. And in this particular universe, they all spin in a particular direction. And the rate at which they spin, for lack of a simpler way to put it, the speed at which these subatomic particles, these electrons, spin around the nucleus is determined in large part by the amount of interaction that they have with something called zero-point energy. Now, that's actually a more simplified name for something that is called quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum in the physics community. Now, that name comes from the fact that this is a type of ambient energy. It's everywhere in the environment, and it can be detected as a slight electrical flux or charge, even down to a temperature of 0 degrees Kelvin, where literally all movement that's related to heat is absent. It is the German physicists in the early years of detecting this used to call as a Zitterbewegung, which means jiggle in German.
Okay.
This is something that was detectable. In fact, Nikola Tesla knew about this around the turn of the century, between the 1890s, early 1900s, and he had actually determined that it also existed or could be detected in a kind of electromagnetic wave, what he was calling longitudinal waves, which more recently have come to be known as scalar waves. Now, to give your audience an idea of what a scalar wave might look like, because it's actually a kind of a compression wave, it would be the same as if you laid a strand of pennies out on a smooth table, one touching the next and the next and so on. And then you took another penny and you flicked it into the end of that row. And they all remain stationary, but the one that's on the other end of the line pops off the end and continues, and with none of the intervening pennies moving. Now, that is the perfect model of at least one part of a longitudinal wave. It moves back and forth along the longitudinal axis of the path of emission. In some cases, you find that, another example would be this little toy that you can get at some of the gift shops. It looks like a little wood frame with some ball bearings suspended by fish line, and you pull one of the ball bearings out and you let it swing back in sort of a pendulum fashion.
Back
it hits
and
the other balls,
yeah.
And it keeps going back and forth. Now,
that's really
an even better sort of mechanical model of what a longitudinal wave is all about. But because of the way these models, or because these energy forms transit through space-time, they allow for a lot of interesting things to happen. For example, there was a gentleman back around 1903, who was a contemporary of Einstein, Edmund T. Whittaker, wrote a couple of papers that were produced or published in a German physics journal. I think it was called Mathematische Annalen, or the Analysis of Mathematics, that are more commonly known as the first and second Whittaker papers, Edmund T. Whittaker. And he talked about the fact that these so-called longitudinal waves could not only be modulated like an AM-FM radio signal, but they could also be broadcast. They could be transmitted and received. Now, getting back to this energy form, and I'm trying to kind of help you visualize this, if you looked at matter as a moving system of little tiny particles on the atomic level, these things are always in motion. They're like the perfect perpetual motion machine. They never stop. They never slow down. They never cease to exist. I think it was Einstein that said that matter could neither be created nor destroyed. Well, so matter itself, in a sense, is sort of the perfect free energy device. It is something that always exists, it never goes away, it never slows down. But the question is, why? Why do these little particles never slow down? Why do they keep going? And it is because there is energy that is sort of boiling up into this dimension out of sort of a parallel hyperspace, if you will, and that is what they believe is going on with the appearance of zero-point energy in the environment. And it is almost immediately absorbed by all the subatomic particles in this particular dimension. And so that is essentially what keeps everything in motion, at least on the atomic and subatomic level. So imagine, if you will, that you have all these little particles spinning around very, very quickly. And it's almost like a child's top, or a yo-yo. Once it starts spinning, it has a certain amount of energy. And in fact, if you spin a top or even a little like a gyroscope, a little model, sort of like a little bicycle wheel held in a cage, if you spin it fast enough, it actually creates kind of a field that resists movement from external sources. In other words, you can take a top, and if you spin it fast enough, it feels kind of hard to move it. It resists movement because it's got this its own self-contained little field that it creates a force. Well, if you imagine every atom in our universe being like that, and then you found a way to prevent that spinning motion from continuing, if you found a way of interrupting that absorption of zero-point energy, you could then get those particles to slow down, and the effect of mass and inertia would drop away. It would begin to decrease. Now, you've probably seen the program Stargate SG-1.
Oh, sure.
We talk about inertial dampeners. Well, now you have to remember that the very reason that Einstein said it is impossible to go faster than the speed of light is because as you accelerate through space-time, your mass increases. Now, mass is a variable. It fluctuates as you accelerate through space-time, as you go through the environment, it increases, and as you slow down, it decreases. So it's a variable thing. Now, if you realize that the whole underlying cause of the effect of mass and inertia is this interaction, this powering up of the subatomic particles by the existence and interaction with zero-point energy, then you begin to realize that if there's some way that you can block that interaction so that it doesn't happen, then the atomic structure begins to lose its mass. Even though it remains intact as a structure, it begins to reduce its mass. It's not the same thing, but it would be kind of like saying it weighs less.
Are we violating any laws of physics then?
Well, not necessarily, because now here's the thing. One of the reasons that Einstein said that you couldn't go faster than the speed of light was because as you accelerate through space-time, your mass increases. Well, why does that happen? It's because as you go through the environment, the rate at which you encounter this energy increases. So it means the little subatomic particles in the nucleus of every atom, they begin to spin faster and faster. In a sense, they become more energized. And when that happens, the effect of mass like I said before, which is variable, it begins to increase. So if you have a way of blocking that energy, that interaction, you, in essence, can change what is supposed to be happening to something else. In other words, you, if you, let's say, for example, you are able to exploit and use that energy that would otherwise increase the mass of your vehicle and use that energy as a propulsive force, then work is conserved. You are not losing anything. You're not violating any physical laws. What you're doing is you're exploiting energy in an environment to propel your aircraft forward or your vehicle forward, and at the same time, you're reducing the effect of mass and inertia. So, and you have to remember that as you begin to move through space-time faster and faster, when this interaction would normally increase more and more and more, what it means, what it really means, is that you have more and more energy available to go even faster still, while at the same time you continue to decrease what the actual mass of your vehicle is.
Is this technology, though, Mark, alien technology? If anything we've talked about tonight is, to me, it sounds like it's this.
Well, that's the funny question. That's really the $25,000 question, George, because the very first time that I was told by an eyewitness, and I have multiple eyewitnesses on this particular type of technology, it was actually referred to as an alien reproduction vehicle. Now, that in and of itself suggests that...
Credible people, Mark?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. People that have worked in the aerospace industry, just like I have, for some of the biggest defense contractors out there, just like I have. In fact, one of the earliest witnesses that I have spoken with is good friends with an editor at a trade journal, Aviation Week and Space Technology. And he was actually a crew chief at Edwards Air Force Base in 1973 and was asked to go over to an installation at the north end of the complex called Edwards North Base Facility. It's where they usually keep most of the classified test vehicles buttoned up and away from prying eyes. And he was a crew chief on an aircraft that was being flight tested, a non-classified aircraft, I might add. But he was asked to go over to North Base and pick up what we used to call in the Air Force a mule, which is a ground power unit that supplies hydraulic pressure to the control surfaces of an aircraft when the engine is not running. And he was told that after he took this particular component, towed it with a slow-moving tow vehicle to the maintenance depot, that he could leave for the rest of the evening. He was on, you know, a graveyard shift to begin with, so going home early was something that he was looking forward to. So, but, you know, here he was, about a 22 or 23-year-old kid, and naturally he thought, well, you know, the security over there is so tight.
Sure.
Rather than taking perimeter road around to the past the north gate of Edwards and around to the west end of the North Base complex, he just cut straight across the dry lake bed where the shuttle lands and figured that when he came up on the tarmac that they would, you know, the security people would spot him before he even got there, and they would meet him at the edge of the tarmac and say, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
So, but the problem was they were expecting him at the gate, and so that's where they were at, and they didn't meet him when he came up on the tarmac. So he was driving this tow vehicle down this row of sort of Quonset hut-style hangars and saw one down the line that had the doors cracked a foot or two and the lights on. He figured, well, that's where it's got to be. And he rolled up in front of this opening on the tow vehicle, and here is this thing sitting in the hangar, flat on the bottom, sloping sides, kind of like a bell shape with a dome on the top, little glass bubbles all over the top with what looked like a camera system in each one, no windows, a little bit of a ledge around the base of this dome, which is actually the top half of a sphere-shaped crew compartment. In fact, if some of your listeners go up to the website, you can actually see a cutaway illustration of what this vehicle looked like.
Now, whose was it?
Well, This was something that apparently had been back engineered from something that had been recovered. Now, if you think about the time span between, say, 1947 and, you know, the so-called Roswell incident,
right,
and 1973, when this particular event, you know, the young man going
to
North Base,
yeah,
you know, that's what
26 years,
20, 25 years or something, and so it's completely within the realm of possibility that over 20 years' time, if you have enough funding and enough time and enough brilliant minds to look at a completely foreign propulsion system, that you might be able to figure out a part of it. Now, the interesting thing is that there was another witness who said that he had seen this thing at Norton Air Force Base as well, which, as you may recall, is the same facility where Philip Corso indicated that they had one of these particular kinds of aircraft that from time to time you could go to, you know, if you were a high-level brass in the military, you could go there and play golf and go over and kick the tires on a flying saucer. Well, it turns out there was a golf course practically right next to the main runway at Norton Air Force Base. It was literally about a mile from where I used to live in the city of Rialto back in the late 80s, early 1990s. And I, on occasion would go to air shows there, when they had them on an annual basis. So, I had a friend who had gone there and had expected to see the SR-71 Blackbird and some other things, and he wound up being in the company of someone who had the credentials and had the influence to get him into a little show that was going on in the big hangar at the facility. I think it was building number 625, if I remember correctly. I'd have to check that particular fact out. But he had an opportunity to see these things, and there were a number of other aircraft, including the so-called Aurora, the first generation of which was really more or less sort of a rounded diamond-shaped type of aircraft.
And again, maybe reverse engineered, at least in terms of looks and appearance?
Well, the Aurora aircraft was actually much closer to the original shape that Kelly Johnson at Lockheed and Ben Rich stumbled across when they were looking at the ideal shape for a stealthy type of aircraft. They had actually talked about a kind of clipped or faceted, flattened out diamond shape as being pretty much the ideal and perfect stealthy shape. And in fact, that's pretty much what this aircraft looked like. Now, another thing that you might be interested in is there is a painting that I did recently for a friend of mine, Mike Schratt, who commissioned a painting of the so-called F-19. Well, it would appear, based on the shape and the orientation of the propulsion system, that this so-called F-19 was actually sort of the proof of concept aircraft for the Aurora, in that it had the same kind of a body, no wings, really just a flattened out diamond shape with a little bit of a ridge that ran laterally across the sort of lifting body fuselage, if you will, with a sort of triangular shaped NACA duct type inlets for the engine, with some ports on the trailing edge that allowed the exhaust gases from the engines to come out. But this particular version had both a dorsal and a ventral vertical stabilizer. That is, it had a tail above and below the fuselage, kind of like a sunfish.
Sure.
In fact, there's an image of that particular painting that I did for Mike on the website that they can go and look to. And in fact, it'll give you also an idea of, imagine that same thing without the tails, and you've essentially got what was the first generation Aurora. Now, in 1997, Jane's Defense Weekly published a rather rudimentary illustration that was supposed to have come from the Phantom Works of McDonnell Douglas near, I think it's Tempe, Arizona, which is also near Phoenix. And it had almost this exact same shape. Now, the interesting thing about that was that the drawing showed two inlets, but three exhaust ports. Now, my thinking here is that this was kind of artistic shorthand for what was really going on with the propulsion system, because one of the witnesses that I had spoken with about this particular aircraft said that it actually had two different kinds of propulsion systems, a set of internal engines that had a set of inlets that would open up trapdoor fashion to let air in for the engines, and then some exhaust ports that were also like trapdoors that would open and close depending on what they were doing. But there was also a slight ridge that ran crossways across the widest part of the body, and they would spray fuel out of these fuel injectors along the trailing edge of that, and it would basically pinch the rear of the vehicle and drive it forward at up to 12,000 miles per hour.
Stay with us, Mark. Much more to talk about with you when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour, and I'm sure many of you will have questions about that acetone fuel additive because I'm getting hit with thousands of emails. But we'll be back in a moment. We'll continue chatting with Mark McKendlish. And I got to tell you, this sketch that I've got of the alien reproduction vehicle cutaway that he has on his website is really something. I want to talk with you, Mark, about that when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Mark McKendlish. Mark, this incredible sketch here that we have on your website, and there's also a link to it on coasttocoastam.com, of this object, this cutaway that you were talking about. Clearly, you can see the spot where these extraterrestrials or these pilots, whomever might be in this craft, would sit at the top. There's not much room else for anything. How big was this object, and is it possible it's some kind of time machine?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, George. The ejection seats are actually an ACES II ejection seat right out of your typical F-4 Phantom that was built by McDonnell Douglas. They do, however, have a kind of foot tray underneath them that's on a kind of a modified a chassis or frame that goes underneath the seat to support that tray, and that's largely because the circular floor beneath those seats is actually part of a static electricity generator, if you will, like kind of like a Wimshurst generator, I think you might say. And so, you want to keep your feet up off the floor while it's spinning, particularly from the corona discharge, the electrostatic charge that comes off that as it's spinning. There were actually three different versions of this vehicle, all pretty much having the same proportions. The smallest of which was about 24 feet in diameter at the base. The next largest size was approximately 60 feet in diameter, and the largest one was approximately 125 to 130 feet in diameter.
Well, that's
now,
pretty big.
Yes, in fact. The only thing that really changed, proportionally speaking, on any of those vehicles was the size of the hatch, which remained the same on all three vehicles, and the so-called synthetic vision system that was responsible for allowing the pilot, wearing a specially fitted helmet with sort of a viewing screen on the inside of the visor, would allow him to actually have binocular three-dimensional vision outside of the craft, pairing up a couple of the cameras with a special system that allowed him to literally have both left and right eye viewing to produce a three-dimensional image.
Not much room to walk around.
No. I mean, you pretty much climb in, sit down, and then go.
You better get to where you're going in like an instant because you're going to go crazy sitting in this thing.
No restroom on this bird.
No. That's a good point. What are these tanks? What are these tanks for?
Well, now, most of the tanks, there's a group that are mounted directly under this sort of electrostatic generator, and there are also a set that are sort of radially mounted around the inside of the bottom of the vehicle, and these are all oxygen tanks. They use a system allows the craft to go beyond the atmosphere, or at least to the upper reaches of it at a minimum, and that's how the pilot and crew members are able to breathe.
Now, are we talking about humans in this thing or extraterrestrials?
Yes. No, this was my belief, based on everything that I've been told by a number of witnesses, was that this was actually our earliest attempt at making an anti-gravity type propulsion vehicle.
Based on alien technology?
Well, that seems to be the conclusion,
right.
Mostly because of the name that they gave it, whether or not it actually had its
right,
origin.
That could have been just
it could have been just a joke, you know.
Could have been a joke.
Looks like a flying saucer,
absolutely
we'll call
right.
it, you know. So,
was it ever used, do you think, tested?
Yes. In fact, one of the witnesses described seeing a video that was produced at a site that very much had the appearance of what you might expect to see at Area 51, a dry lake bed, mountains way off in the distance. the vehicle hovering, isolated and hovering in the middle of this dry lake bed. And during the initial movements, the vehicle makes three sort of sidelong hopping motions, sort of, you know, arching up and then down again to the height that it began hovering at, and then did that three times, and then paused momentarily, and then accelerated straight up and out of sight, disappearing from view in just a few seconds. Now, that by itself is a pretty remarkable feat,
right,
any way you cut it. But you have to remember that if you have a propulsion system that is drawing the so-called zero-point energy out of the local environment, so the mass of your vehicle is being decreased dramatically, it means that causing it to accelerate suddenly doesn't become all that much of a chore. Now, you know, I can just hear the pilots out there saying, well, what about all the G-forces? Why isn't the pilot just squashed against the inside of the vehicle? Well, you have to remember that inertia comes from having mass. If you don't have any mass, there's no inertia. In a sense, the inertia is dampened, just like they say on the TV shows. I mean, there really is some legitimacy to the claim of being able to dampen inertia, but you do it by blocking or interrupting the interaction with zero-point energy, principally by using it as the main source of your propulsive energy.
Well, this is that propulsion system alone is pretty remarkable.
It is.
The fact that they worked on it and it's still been hidden boggles my mind, Mark, because you'd think they'd be using this kind of technology all over the place.
Well, I mean, I've already envisioned applying this particular technology to automotive use, to power generation. In fact, I think this is probably the main reason, if not one of the main reasons, that we haven't seen the technology declassified. I mean, from a tactical and strategic standpoint, if you've got a vehicle that can literally be all the way around on the other side of the planet in probably under 10 minutes, which is, you know, three times faster than the best ICBM, and use it as a platform for deploying a weapon, whether it's a tactical weapon or a strategic weapon, you have a tremendous advantage over any enemy. But as a source of power generation, you have to understand that just bringing this right out and putting it into a non-classified status might severely disrupt the world economy, because everything we know of is based on fossil fuels. But the positive aspect of this, in my view, is that even as the jet engine eventually replaced the propeller-driven aircraft, it took decades before, you know, everything was propelled by jet engines, or at least the majority of aircraft were flown around with that particular type of propulsion. And I think the same would be true for bringing this kind of technology out and using it for a way of, sort of reducing our use of fossil fuels, improving or lessening the impact of fossil fuels on the environment, and giving us an alternative source to nuclear energy, which of course has some long-term drawbacks.
Absolutely.
Because of radioactivity and the waste.
Let's chat for a moment as we go up to the top of the hour in about 15 minutes about the alien abduction phenomenon, because you have also looked at this. I mean, you are
pretty
varied in your career. Tell me what you have found so far, Mark.
Well, it occurred to me, because I've always been kind of a car nut and a nuts and bolts kind of guy. I've always been fascinated by how things work. You know, I heard about these. There was a fellow by the name of Billy Goodman. He used to have a show, sort of the predecessor show in this genre, out of Las Vegas, that talked about, you know, flying saucers and abductions and this kind of thing. And it occurred to me that if any of these people really were being abducted by aliens, and there was a very, very slight chance, you know, maybe just a very slight chance, that they might have seen some kind of propulsion technology if these events were real, if they were really happening. Now, I went into this whole thing very, very skeptical at the outset. And I called up the Billy Goodman show, and I said, you know, I heard, you know, a couple of these abductees that you had on your program the other night, and I'm an artist, I'm interested in, you know, advanced technologies, and I'd be interested in talking to any of, you know, these young ladies that had these experiences and find out whether or not this is really true. And maybe they saw something that might be, you know, sort of a piece of the puzzle, if you will. Well, it turns out I was right. Of the half dozen or so people that I interviewed, at least two had seen propulsion system components. Now, the interesting thing here is that I wasn't motivated to make any of these kinds of inquiries until I had been told about this so-called mm-hmm. alien reproduction vehicle. I mean, that for me at least suggested that this might be a reality. So I thought, well, okay, well, let's look over in this other area and see sure. what we can find out.
That would do it for me.
Well, but the odd thing about it, George, was that several of these abductee claimants were describing propulsion system components that blow for blow were almost identical in shape, size, relative size, and configuration as what you see right there in the ARV. And these were in other types of vehicles. I mean, you know, not everything in the way of UFOs, you know, are flying saucers. Some of them are sphere-shaped. Some of them are like cylinders or the so-called cigar-shaped UFOs. And in every case, the components that they were describing usually involved a large central column with some kind of a device that was spinning around it. In some cases, the column was even spinning in the opposite direction.
Spinning's very important in
yes.
all this.
Well, in this case, counter-rotation seems to be one of the keys. But the thing that I found interesting, too, was that if you go back through the UFO literature and you look at some of the accounts, especially some of the things that were recorded by Jim and Coral Lawrenson back in the 1950s and 1960s, you find that there are certain specific materials that come up and recur over and over again in the allegations of crashed UFOs, material that is dropped from UFOs that appear to be in trouble or shooting off sparks. And there are two things that we see often, magnesium and mercury. Now, as it happens, one of the witnesses that described this propulsion system said that mercury was one of the key components that was used inside this central column that is actually inside the secondary windings of a very, very large Tesla coil. Now, for some of the audience who don't know what a Tesla coil is, if you've seen any of the old Frankenstein movies where they have these lightning bolts shooting around Frankenstein's laboratory,
right.
those are sort of a kind of Tesla coil. And what it really is it's just a way of taking a certain voltage of electricity, and you create a kind of an open-air transformer that steps up the voltage but drops down the amperage. And so you can get lightning bolts that look very dramatic, but in some cases, you know, won't even really harm you. You know, the components that some of these abductees were describing were so similar that, you know, I begin to think that this was, you know, really a legitimate claim. But the thing that convinced me more than anything else with regard to the so-called abductees was the fact that they actually had artifacts, if you will, that were not only visible on CAT scans and MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging type of scans, but in one case there was a young lady who had devices that had actually been implanted behind her eardrum that more or less seemed to be replacing the little tiny bones that go between your eardrum and the inner ear, the so-called tympanic bones, were replaced in at least two cases on this one individual over the course of about 4 years. What was interesting in that case was that the young lady actually also claimed to be or have been abducted by the military, undergoing a rather grueling examination of you know, just about every part of her body, and in the process went through a really brutal interrogation that left bruises and abrasions down the back of her throat, and they actually wound up damaging one of these auditory implants. Within the following 6 months, the so-called aliens came back, abducted her again, not only replaced the damaged unit in her ear, but put in a second one in the other side. And the reason I know this is because she had gone out and purchased, before any of this had happened, she had gone out and purchased a professional quality otoscope, this little, you know, flashlight thing with a little cone on it that the ear, nose, and throat doctor would kind of use to look in your ear and check out, you know, the health of your eardrum and that kind of thing. What most people don't realize is that the eardrum is so thin, it's like a cellophane membrane. It's translucent. You can see through it. And if it's wet, it's almost like a piece of glass. And so, you know, I looked in this young lady's ear, And I could clearly see, in the latter instance, what appeared to be something like a small metallic, sort of a hockey puck-shaped disc sitting on its edge behind her eardrum, and clearly appeared to be completely replacing the tympanic bones. And in fact, one of the things that she recounted from her military abduction was that overhearing a conversation between a couple of officers in this underground facility where she was taken in the high desert of Southern California, that if they remove this thing, it would certainly permanently impair her hearing. She would probably be deaf from that point on, but it may well kill her as well. And so they opted not to do that. But apparently the aliens were able to replace it after it was damaged. And when I looked in her ear to see exactly what the methodology was that they had used, you could see three spiral cuts that ran down the ear canal leading right up to the eardrum, where they had obviously sort of literally screwed some kind of a mandrel into, or guide, if you will, into the ear canal to very carefully channel whatever surgical instruments were used to go in and replace this device. Now,
amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Is stunning, stunning, absolutely stunning. But one of the other individuals that I spoke to had claimed that in the early 1970s that she had been, as a young girl, had been on the way to a ballet lesson with her mom, had had a missing time experience, and then began to have sort of a recollection of what had happened. And she described the approach of a kind of Saturn-shaped UFO that came out of the west right at sunset, managed to stall all of the cars at an intersection where they were sitting in a light, and then a beam of incredible white light came out of this disc and rendered the entire right half of her parents, her mother's car, transparent. And she said that there were these three little individuals that looked like sort of a puffy little Casper the Friendly Ghost type of beings with big black eyes that came walking over and said, "There's been an accident. We need to take you to the hospital." And they pulled her right out through the metal of the car like it was water. And so, you know, I asked her, "Well, you know, how do you know that this really happened?" She says, "Well, I have these implants that show up on the MRIs." And I said, "Well, now how were these put in?" She said, "Well, I woke up inside the craft, laying on a kind of soft, what looked like a metal table, but it was pliable, just like a rubber cushion."
So for a guy like you who's been involved in real hard science for a number of years, mm-hmm. all this is not new to you. To me, you sound like you're a believer now.
Well, I wasn't in the beginning, buddy. I'm now. And you know, for me, George, this, you know, I really had to wrestle with this because, you know, I mean, hearing these stories, you know, seeing a couple of these deep scars in the roof of this young lady's mouth where they literally just pressed these two little spheres right through the skin and the roof of her mouth into the lower part of her brain cavity with no anesthetic, I might add.
And she's okay.
Yeah. I mean, but she passed out, but these things are there. You can see the skin. In fact, she showed me the scars. I could look in there with the flashlight and see them in the roof of her mouth. And it was very clear what they were, you know. You know, all of this still didn't quite seem like reality to me until finally on the 13th of December, 1989, I was coming back from a date with my girlfriend. We were sitting at a light right just immediately north of the Ontario International Airport in Ontario, California, just on the overpass that goes right over the top of Interstate 10, running through the community of Rancho Cucamonga. And we're sitting there. It's a 10:45. We're looking at Los Angeles mountain range north of there, where Mount Baldy and some other places are. Full moon out. You know, it's December. There's snow on the mountains. Clear night. You can see the stars. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes this brilliant bluish white orb from the southeast, going like a son of a gun. And it comes from the southeast. I caught it out of the corner of my eye through the windows of the car. And it drops down in front of the mountains, makes a right angle turn, never slows down.
Not a meteorite, is it?
No. Definitely not a meteorite. Makes a right angle turn to the left, goes about a mile, makes another right angle turn, and goes up through Chaco Canyon, which goes, if you follow that valley, it goes right up to the high desert where Edwards Air Force Base is. In fact, if you follow the trajectory, if you plot it on a map, it's going right to Edwards Air Force, Edwards Air Force Base.
Are you convinced it was extraterrestrial?
Well, in that particular instance, because of the direction it was traveling, not entirely. But I have to tell you that I plotted the time to distance. It was doing at least 5,000 miles an hour,
well,
and there was no sonic boom.
I don't think we have that kind of technology. When we come back, it's phone line time on Coast to Coast AM.